Hi, I'm Ron Bailey for Reason Television, and we have Matt Ridley, the author of the fabulous new book, The Rational Optimist, How Prosperity Evolves, and we're going to be talking about that.
Lovely to see you, Ron.
So tell us quickly, what is the basic 25-word elevator speech version of the book?
Things are getting better. Human living standards are improving in extraordinary ways all the time and have been for a long time. And that's because of an evolving, spontaneous order in society that's coming about through free exchange and specialization. And it's where that process comes from and why it's happening to our species when it doesn't happen to others that I'm interested in.
So as I understand it, the simple way to describe the book is you say ideas have sex. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that for biological evolution to work, you have to have sexual reproduction, because that brings together genetic mutations from different individuals and brings them onto the same team, as it were. Now, for cultural evolution to get going, you've got to have exchange between different individuals, because otherwise one tribe might invent one tool and another tribe might invent the other, and they're going to go to war, and whoever has the best tool wins, and the other tool goes extinct. But if you want both tools and you want to combine the tools, then there's got to be exchange between groups. And that was actually a surprisingly hard thing for animals to invent, I reckon. And it was us that did it first, properly, around 100,000 years ago. And it was as if ideas started having sex, and that meant a ramping up of continually, exponentially improving prosperity for the human species.
But it took a long time. As you say, it started 100,000 years ago, and for some reason or other, it sped up quite considerably in the last 200. What happened in that part?
In the first 100,000 years, it seems to be that it comes and goes, and it seems to be to do with population density. And then for thousands of years after that, you get horrible things that set it back, like emperors and wars and basically predators. You know, there's always a tendency of human beings to plunder each other, and that can set the whole process back. What seems to have happened around 1800, and there are lots of different versions of this. I mean, a lot of people say that that ideas started meeting each other much better through the medium of science and that kind of thing. I don't myself think that. I think it's all about fossil fuels, i.e. that when we started getting really cheap sources of energy, we could amplify the work we do. And the secret of modern society and the secret of prosperity is that we're working for each other. Each of us is working for each other. So if each of us amplifies our work with a huge dose of fossil fuel energy, then we can do all the more for each other, so we can make each other more prosperous. And so I think that the reason it takes off around 1800 and the rate of growth of the world suddenly gets a lot faster then and doesn't have so many setbacks, though there are some in individual countries, is because of fossil fuels.
You're still an energy determinist. Oh well.
Yeah. you've done your best to dissuade me over the years, and maybe you'll succeed one day, but not yet.
But one of the ways, when you say you're working, we work for each other. You have a wonderful analogy about the number of people it took to prepare the Sun King, the King of France's meals. And you compare that to what today? How does that work? Could you give
us the King Louis XIV of France had 498 people to prepare his dinner every night. Allegedly, that's what I've read. But you and I have 498 people to prepare our lunch today, by which I mean that within 10 miles of here, there are at least 498 restaurants that you or I could go to, and each of them is prepared to serve us with a very nice meal, probably with more exotic ingredients than Louis XIV ever saw, at an hour's notice. What's the difference as far as we're concerned? I mean, they're not working exclusively for us, but what's the difference?
Why is it that pessimism sells? Why is it so popular? Why is the world always coming to an end?
This is a question I find very hard to answer. I don't myself quite understand why pessimism sounds wise and optimism sounds foolish, but that's true. I mean, you know, everybody seems to agree on that. And maybe it's just because people are cautious. Maybe it's because they're nostalgic. They somehow think that the world was better before. Maybe it's because it's almost superstitious. You know, you're wanting to head it off or prepare for it. And by the way, that's one of the reasons I use the phrase rational optimism. I don't think starry-eyed, individual, everything's fine optimism is the right way to go. What I'm saying is imagine the possible improvement that you could achieve, and thereby don't lose sight of the possibility, and don't give up on the possibility of improving the world. So I'm very much not saying everything's fine. I'm saying quite the reverse. There's a lot of things that could get better still. Don't let's give up on the possibility of improving them.
And this, and you have a lot of data showing how things improved in the last half of the 20th century. Could you share some of that with us?
Yeah, my sort of headline summary is that I've worked out that in my life, the average citizen of the planet is three times richer, corrected for inflation, that his lifespan is a third longer, that he's burying one-third as many of his children, which is a terribly important measure of happiness, if you like, and that food per head is up about a third, and the population growth rate has halved in my lifetime. Not a lot of people know that, but it's true.
How do you see the 21st century working out? We're at a time of financial crisis now. There's a climate change problem, possibly. So what is the 21st century going to look like?
Well, my estimation, and, you know, I'm no better at forecasting the future than anyone else, is that we will have some pretty dire times as a result of the financial crisis in the West. And they could, you know, they could last a long time. I don't know. But that on the whole, that won't interrupt the improvement in average living standards across the globe, because China and India are still experiencing growth, and there's evidence that Africa is joining in increasingly. Latin America is doing better, etc. So a large proportion of the planet is going to see this recession as a local problem, not as a global problem. As for the longer term, there will be wars, there will be droughts, there will be earthquakes, there will be volcanoes, there will be all sorts of horrible things happen to the human race, as happened in the 20th century. And the 20th century was a pretty bad century from the point of view of wars and dictatorships and things like that. And yet, throughout that period, human living standards inexorably rose. And so that's what I think is going to happen in the 21st century. As for climate, well, I think there is a small possibility of a big disaster, but there is a very large probability of a moderate change in the climate, which will actually mostly be beneficial. Slightly warmer weather, slightly more moisture in the air will produce slightly higher crop yields and relatively little impact on things like storms and droughts and species range and so on. Now, I might be wrong, and we've of course got to prepare for the outside possibilities of things being badly wrong. But I don't myself think it is probable that we will face a bad century.
But there is always the problem that you have identified, is that there are groups of human beings, we'll call them chieftains, priests, and thieves, I believe you refer to them as, who could possibly try to interrupt this. So how do we get around those people?
Well, we somehow, the great thing about societies that have really worked well, you know, Hong Kong recently, Holland in the 17th century, etc., is that they've somehow placed the incentives in the right place. So it made more sense to go into sensible commerce in which you benefited everybody than it did to go into warfare as a profession, say, in which you benefit pretty well nobody except possibly yourself. So we've somehow got to make sure that the incentives are pointing in that direction for people. Now, I don't think we're that worried about ambitious emperors militarily invading other countries so much at the moment, although, you know, we've got to watch that a bit. But I do think we should worry about the degree to which a lot of big government, although it has a role, clearly, in terms of holding the ring as a referee, in terms of ensuring free and fair activity in society, can also be a plunderer. Big government, big corporations can do that. Big finance can do that. You know, the predators and the parasites can come from many different directions. And I think we've just got to always keep an eye on whether the incentives are pointing towards them or not.
Would you call yourself a libertarian?
I think I would call myself a libertarian. I don't think I'm a sort of hole up in a forest in the Rockies and shoot anyone who comes near kind of libertarian, if that's what the word means. But I'm certainly a believer that on the whole, society is a bottom-up phenomenon. In other words, people spontaneously produce social order through free and fair exchange among themselves. The balance of risk in this world seems to me about too much top-down control, not too little. And I would love to see a little more attention to letting people free to get on with their lives.
Well, thank you very much, Matt, for coming into Reason. So, Matt Ridley for Reason Television. And if you want to hear more of this, join us on the Reason Cruise next year. Thank you very much.